for the last year, mostly off. But it's on automating the post-Newtonian expansion on a computer using symbolic packages like Mathematica. And there's a couple of good reasons to do this. So the most immediate one is relevant for LIGO, in that thanks to Michele Vallisneri and Ira Rothstein for this table, that that you can see sort of what's in this table is what's been accomplished in the post-Newtonian expansion to date. So for example, you can see up to 3PN, everything's been computed for non-spinning bodies, but for spinning bodies, there's quite a lack of results, particularly for the waveforms. So there's still quite a bit to work left to do in this, and of course this requires calculating high order terms to these and to complete off the equations of motion at 3.5 PN. So it becomes a very involved calculation. So this is kind of my main reason for wanting to do automation. But there are other reasons which have been talked about in Capra yesterday and today. That where automating the post-Newtonian expansion might be really good. I really can't see this. So the first is that if you know the post-Newtonian potentials at higher order, you can construct more accurate semi-analytical models like the effect of one body, for example. You can also do things like make better comparisons, at least from the post-Newtonian side, with numerical relativity and self-force results. And in some sense, you can also do some practical computation of self-force effects, because if you know, for example, the flux at a higher order, you can use this in Kluge methods. And it also could be useful for binaries with intermediate mass ratios and so on. Okay. But from a more pragmatic viewpoint, aside from LIGO, there's another issue in that it's not really possible to do these things completely by hand. So you certainly don't want to ask a graduate student to do that, because they'll just kill themselves. So instead, it's nice to put it on a computer. But perhaps the most important reason of all is that it's just plain cool. So the idea of being able to do a complicated but important calculation at the touch of a button, I mean, is, I think, kind of a nice, interesting thing. Now, in this talk, if I'm going to be putting something on a computer, I need some sort of theoretical framework to talk about what I'm doing on the computer. So I'm going to be using what's called the effective field theory approach. And just by a show of hands, does anyone know or have heard of that approach? OK, does anyone know how to calculate with it? OK, no. So again, another good reason for the program, right? OK, so well, what's the effective field theory approach? Well, I'll tell you in the next slide. But there's been a bunch of work on it in the past 4 or 5 years since it's been introduced. You can read this up there, but calculating potentials, looking at alternative theories. The question mark on the higher dimensional black hole stuff, I couldn't remember the authors, and I couldn't find the paper, but I know I remember reading something about it. So since I'm sure the authors aren't here, I think it's okay. Okay, so a really quick overview of the landscape of the effective field theory approach as applied to the binary problem is that well, you have essentially three scales in the problem, certainly for comparable masses, namely the size of the compact objects, RM, their orbital separation, and the wavelength of the radiation they emit. And so in the effective field theory approach, what you do is you describe the system sort of by a hierarchy of theories. So at the very smallest scale, you have a compact object, some finite size object. And you say, well, if I zoom out from that, it looks like a point particle, but with some slight deformations due to induced tidal moments raised by the external background. Or maybe it has maybe there's a neutron star that has a mountain that can emit gravitational waves and so on. And so there's a systematic way to include these kind of multiple effects into a point particle formalism. And this is done in the effective field theory quite nicely, but I'm not going to talk about that, because there's no bearing on the post-Newtonian expansion until 5 PN for non-spinning bodies. So, okay, so if you zoom out from the compact object, you can describe it as a point particle plus maybe some other terms describing the finite size effect. But if you zoom out from that further, okay, now you have two point particles trapped in a potential that's generated by each other. And so this is sort of the framework that I'm going to be talking about. So if you kind of keep zooming out, you see this binary here, and it obviously radiates because of that blue squiggle. And so I'm going to be talking about this. And of course, if you zoom out further, the binary looks just like a composite object with some extra moments, like spin, which is related to the angular momentum of the binary, and so on. Okay, so how do you calculate in this approach? Okay, well, in this talk, like I said, well, maybe I didn't say that, I'm only going to talk about calculating potentials. So I'm not going to talk about calculating flux, waveforms, and so on. So I just want to focus on potentials because for right now, that's the easiest thing to do on the computer and in some ways the first thing that you need to do. So in this approach, you start with an action. Okay, so the action is just that of general relativity, so the Einstein-Hilbert action, plus the sum of two-point particle actions. And these things can, you know, they're the usual minus m integral d tau, and if you want to include some finite size effects, there's some extra terms in there. But the idea is to take this, expand about flat space-time, so if you get some one term, this as zero of h, which essentially describes the kinetic behavior or the leading order behavior of the field. So essentially when you vary that, you get box h in the Lorentz cage, say, or the harmonic cage, plus the usual kinetic term for the two bodies, 1/2 mv squared, plus all the other perturbative corrections. So the idea is to integrate out the metric perturbations from the action so that you're left with an action that only depends on the world lines of the two bodies. Okay, and that's called an effective action. And the way you do that is to vary this perturbed action with respect to h, the metric perturbation, solve for h, plug that back into your original action, and now everything depends on only x1 and x2, the two world lines. And this new action is then called the effective action. So when you vary the effective action with respect to the world line coordinates, what you get are the equations of the post-Newtonian equations of motion. Okay? So that intermediate step of solving for h is a little time-consuming, and you can use a more efficient way by introducing sort of a rule-based method that comes from sort of using Feynman diagrams. So I say the word Feynman, but there's really nothing quantum going on here. It's just a way of doing perturbation theory. So in this interaction term of the action, this is just a lightning overview. But there are rules that tell you how, for example, h scales with the velocity and how the mass and so on. So for example, this first term here, the 0,0 part that generates the Newtonian potential, scales like v0 times l to the 1/2. And l is, if you like, the typical angular momentum in the binary, so mvr for circular orbits. Okay, and then from here, you take a variational derivative with respect to the metric perturbation. And you end up with that line there. So the solid line there represents the world line of one of the particles, and the dashed line represents the field. Okay, so you just take a variational derivative. And then you form all the diagrams such that you connect these dotted lines together so that, well, the only things that you have are so-called tree-level diagrams, and also diagrams that are always connected to dotted lines that are connected to each other. So for example, that first guy there is a disconnected diagram, so that's not allowed. And the second diagram there has a loop in the field, so that's actually a quantum effect, so that certainly LIGO is not going to see that. Okay. And the way that the points on the world line are linked together, again with these dotted lines, they're linked together by the propagator. So essentially the Green's function, which for potentials is the Green's function associated with the Laplacian. Okay. So this one. Okay, so at 0 pn, which is the leading order in the post-Newtonian expansion, there are only three diagrams that appear. So you can see that there's a gravitational perturbation that's exchanged between the two particles. And then the last two diagrams are where a gravitational perturbation is emitted but then reabsorbed. Okay, so how do you calculate this diagram? Well, what you do is, using the Feynman rules, you essentially glue up everything together. So for example, this term there comes from the Feynman rule for the first particle there. This term there is essentially the same one before the second particle. And then lastly, there's the propagator that glues the two vertices together. Okay, so you have some expression, you do the contractions, and that leads to the second step, where you have the integral of this 1 over k squared thing. And of course, that's just the usual Fourier transform of the 1 over r potential. Okay, so that's how you get the Newtonian potential in about 2 or 3 octaves. Okay, are there any questions on this point? And it's fairly rule-based here, so when you go to 1pn, it's pretty similar, 2pn, and so on. Okay, but the only the difficult part, however, are the integrals. So I calculated that first diagram there, but if you calculate the second and the third diagrams, they both have a momentum integral that looks like 1 over k squared. And the reason why there's no x dependence is because, well, you have an exponential e to the ik, say x1 minus x1. So that's just 0, or the exponential is 1. But as I think Alexander Leciek showed the other day, quite nicely, I think, that if you use dimensional regularization on this kind of term, then it in fact just equals 0 from the analytic continuation. Okay, and in fact, in dimensional regularization, any divergence that scales with a cutoff as a positive power is just going to be 0 by analytic continuation. So hence, any divergences that you have that are logarithmically divergences are the ones that are physical, and they're corresponding to effects due to gravitational screening effects and so on, just like as in QED with charge minimization. Okay. So that's how you do the Newtonian calculation. However, at higher orders, you get lots and lots more diagrams. And it was found in 2007 by Cole and Smolkin that if you make a smart change of variables in the metric, and if you use a smart gauge, that in fact the number of diagrams that contribute at a given order become reduced. So there's less number of diagrams. And the change of variable is essentially this kind of Kaluza-Klein choice of variables. So you have a scalar field, a vector field, and a symmetric two tensor sigma ij. And when you make this transformation, what you find is that in the original variables, you had these kinds of diagrams plus the other ones that are divergent, which I'm not writing down here because they just renormalize the mass and are not physical. But in these variables, in the Cole-Smolkin variables, that guy right there, which comes from expanding out the Einstein-Hilbert Lagrange into third order in the perturbation, ends up being proportional to phi, phi dot squared. And since there's a time derivative and potentials vary slowly in time, this term is actually reduced by 1pn order. So this diagram actually contributes at 2pn instead of 1pn. And so there are, in fact, just 4 diagrams to calculate. And these are very easy diagrams because they involve no nonlinearities. In the space. Of course, the field is quadratic on the world line on that last diagram, but. Okay. Now, there's this one diagram here, the first diagram, that has this dotted line with this cross circle. So what's that? Well, at 1pn, sorry, at 0pn, we're essentially making the approximation that gravitational perturbations propagate instantaneously. But at 1pn, they don't. So we all know that a gravitational perturbation travels, loosely speaking, at the speed of light. So somehow we have to incorporate these corrections due to retardation effects. Okay, and so you can see if you just look at the sort of relativistic propagator in momentum space, you have this 1 over k0 squared minus 3 vector k squared. And since So the frequency of the gravitational perturbation will be generated, will be determined by the orbit of the binary, which is slowly evolving compared to the length scale of the binary, or I should say compared to the distance. Then you can expand in powers of k0 over k, and then you can replace k0 by a derivative of t and so on because of the exponential. And what you find is this series expansion of the relativistic propagator in terms of the usual Euclidean 3D propagator. Okay? And those terms in the expansion are just simply represented, well, the first one was, some dotted line connecting two points. The second one is this crossed guy. So that's essentially just two time derivatives on the propagator with a 1 over k squared also multiplying it, and so on. There's another term that has two crosses, and so on. Okay? Right. Okay. So that's sort of a lightning quick overview of how to do calculations in the approach. And so now I want to talk about how you do it on a computer. And so the kinds of things to be calculated on the computer are, well, for one, the potentials, but also other things like the flux, the phase, restricted waveforms, the amplitude corrections to the restricted waveforms, and if you really want to, radiation reaction kind of potentials in the sense of Burke and Thorne. Okay, so these are kinds of the things that eventually I want to be able to automate, or at least try to automate significant parts of these. But for now, just focus on potentials. So here's how it goes, roughly the rules in doing this. I just went through about 10 minutes ago. So first you expand your Lagrangian to find whatever interaction terms you need. Okay, and how do you know what you need? Well, you have to power count the interaction terms. So you know how they scale with the velocity. So if you want to calculate the 2PN term, you don't need to expand out, you know, to some term that goes like V to the 7 to the 18 or something, right? So you do this. And when you calculate the interaction terms, since we're working in a post-Newtonian expansion where the time rate of change of potentials is much slower than their spatial rate of change, then you have to be sure to put on the computer somehow the knowledge of a 3+1 decomposition. And then you generate your Feynman rules just by taking a variational derivative of the Fourier transform of the interaction. And then you find the combinations of the interactions at some given order. So for example, in the post-Newtonian, in the Newtonian case, this diagram with the V0, well, I simply just glued two of them together to get the Newtonian calculation, right? Because the Newtonian has to go like V to the 0. It's the leading order contribution. And at 1PN, if I can get through that, and at 1PN, you see, for example, this middle diagram, which I don't know if you can see in the back, but it's labeled by V squared and V0. So you multiply those together, you get that the whole diagram scales like V squared. So that's how you kind of determine which diagrams are going to compute based off of how the interaction scales with velocity. Okay, and then from that, you can construct Feynman diagrams, and then put the expressions all together, and you'll have to evaluate some momentum integrals, and if they diverge, you'll need to worry about regularizing and possibly renormalizing something, some parameters. Okay, so that's sort of the outline of how I want to approach the automation procedure. But the actual implementation requires using something, and I'm no good at programming in C, so I might as well use something that's easy and wide to be available, like Mathematica. However, that's not good enough because it doesn't support sensor calculus natively. So you have to supplement it with something else, and Jose Maria Martin Garcia has done a very nice job of developing the X-Hack suite of packages, him and collaborators, which is perfect for this kind of thing. And I'll show you why. But this website here is where you can download and read more information about it. But it's a suite of packages that allows you to do tensor calculus, perturbation theory on a curved background. You can do component calculations. We can work with spinners and so on. But there are some advantages aside from this in using the X-Act and X-Tensor suite. Number one is that it's free. So MathTensor costs $500. It's fast. It has native support for all the sort of space-time objects, if you will, that we're familiar with. And XPERT is a very, very fast package for doing perturbation theory because it uses explicit expressions. So for example, if you do some benchmarking, what you find is that to arrange, say, n number of anti-symmetric tensors, if you simplify the expression, essentially simplify the arrangement of the indices, which is an important step in any calculation because you need to know that, for example, the metric, if being symmetric, that you need to know that g alpha beta plus g beta alpha equals 2 g alpha beta on a computer. Okay. So if you do this, what you find is that in X-Tensor that you can do, you can simplify 50 of these tensors in about 2 or 3 seconds, whereas MathTensor, that red curve there, takes an undetermined known amount of time, probably a couple years. Okay. So automation, full automation, is probably too lofty. So really what we're after is getting at a set of functions, essentially a package that will help someone to be able to calculate in the post, whatever, some quantities in the post-Newtonian expansion. Okay, and I think since I'm running out of time, what I'll do is give a demonstration of... Well, maybe I will. There we go. Of what's been coded up so far. This is a work in progress, so I unfortunately can't be able to do something as trivial as, you know, get the Newtonian potential on the computer yet. But I guess in some sense I can get the MA equals zero. Okay, so first here, let me load up some packages here. Okay, so starts off with about 6.5 megs, and what it's going to do is it's going to start defining manifolds and metrics and all sorts of things. Okay, so this is kind of the standard extensor startup. Okay, so now that's done. And now I need to start up some variables that I've defined and so on, so let me do that real quick. And in the process, you're going to see in this last step that it's generating rules to transform from the covariant variables to the Cole-Smolkin variables. Okay. So again, that's just setup. And now, again, we need to define some Lagrangians. So we have the usual Einstein-Hilbert Lagrangian. We need to find some way of imposing a gauge, which I'm not going to talk about, but you can do it. And here are the particle Lagrangians. Okay. Okay. So first, let me demonstrate something non-trivial, which is how you do a 3+1 decomposition in a package that has no native 3+1 decomposition or way to decompose. Okay. And the way to do this is to, well, at least a fast way that I found to do this, is to essentially, if you have an expression, so I'm always working with scalars, so take one, for example, H alpha beta, U alpha beta, U beta, and if you multiply essentially by the trace of the metric, okay, without evaluating it, otherwise it'd just be 16 times, but it's just stupid. So if you take the trace of the metric, and you switch the index, one index in each of the trace with one index in each that appears in the expression, and then it's simply expanded out, you can quickly get a 3+1 decomposition. Okay, so now you know, for example, the first term here, which is H00, the second term here is just H0i, and the second term is Hij coupled to Vijj. Okay, and this is important because each of these terms scale differently with velocity. Right, one has one velocity, the other has v squared in it. Okay, so for example, in the example I just gave you, I just ran it, and well, there it is. There's a 3+1 decomposition. Okay, so I'm sorry I have to go through this fast. Okay, so here are some examples of using perturbation theory here. So I've created this function perturb, which takes as input a Lagrangian, and you specify here that you want to perturb with respect to one potential, so h, zero radiation, metric perturbations, and two powers and velocity. And you can do that pretty quick and change it to a 3+1 notation. You can do a more non-trivial one just to check to see if the code works by expanding d tau in minus m integral d tau out to what is it, eighth order or something, and the coefficients agree, which is good. And you can also, you know, expand out to third order in the gravitational perturbations, which is needed for that Mercedes-Benz type diagram, if you actually needed to calculate it in covariant variables. And to get into a more respectable form, you can integrate by parts and so on, and check that, in fact, that expression is the right one by hand. And just to make a check of the formalism, I did this also at fourth order and checked that by hand, and ensure enough it agrees, which means that at fifth order it also works. And so why not at 17th order? And this, of course, has to be changed to a 3+1 notation in order that your interaction terms scale homogeneously with the velocity, so you know which vertices enter which diagrams. This will take a couple seconds. Of course, since I'm giving a talk, it'll probably take a few more. Okay, and it's a long, uninteresting expression. All right. So let me just run a couple of things here without explaining anything. Okay, So here's an example of transforming two Cole-Swoncken variables. So the first line, say, is H00. Actually, the sort of second order H00, if you expand out H as H1 plus H2 and H3 and so on. And you know, the rules that I showed you were being generated earlier are what's behind computing this. And it takes a pretty short amount of time. And so you can compute, for example, the leading order part that gives you the box H in the wave equation in the Cole-Swoncken variables. And you find three sets of terms here, none of which mix. So you have terms that go like, d phi, d phi, and da, da, and d sigma, but there's no d phi, d sigma, or d sigma, da. And this means that the fields don't mix into each other, okay, directly. Maybe through an interaction, but not directly. And finally, you can do the same thing for the interaction of three metric perturbations. Okay, so since my time is almost up, I think I have 4 or 5 minutes. Okay, perfect. Then I think I will end on this and say that from these interactions, thank God I ran these earlier, you can generate all of the interactions that you might need. So let me just scan down the page. So these are all the gravitational interactions involving three fields and so on, being simplified. And you can put this all together and make all the interactions you would need at, say, 1 p.m. But you can do better that and automate the whole thing and say, what if I just want to compute all of the interactions that appear at 1 p.m. and that I'll need to use in my Feynman diagrams? We'll use this function called makeAllInteractions, and it does exactly that. Okay, so it even tells you that it's doing that when it runs. Okay, so it creates this long list, which then these interaction terms, you can compute the Feynman rules just by taking very appropriate number of variational derivatives. And at the end, you can, well, I'm running out of time, but essentially from the power counting rules, you can determine how to combine all these diagrams all these vertices that go into making the diagram. And the last step is to connect them with propagators, which I haven't gotten to yet. But let me just end this by running this one command, which does everything that I really briefly talked about or went through here. So essentially, this is automating the calculation of all of the interactions that are needed at 1 p.m. and forming and determining which vertices are needed for each diagram. And then the next step is to connect them with propagators, which is not done here, but that will be done in a week or two. But anyway, so in about 30 seconds or so, it'll be done. And so you can see it's already calculated the interactions for the first particle, for the second particle. It's working in a harmonic gauge, and it's now computing. It's not crunching out the computation for the expansion of the third in the third order of H. Okay, and then it'll assemble them, and that's it for now. Okay, sorry for the brevity.
Questions for Chad?
The separation of scale in the effective field theory has any relationship with the near zone, far zone of the standard GR post-Newtonian computation?
Sorry, could you repeat that?
Is there any simple relationship between the scales that you can easily separate in your effective field theory and the near zone, far zone of the general relativity standard post-Newtonian?
Yeah, I mean, you can calculate the near zone metric and the far zone metric. So in that step where I said we're integrating out the metric from the action and doing that essentially with the Feynman diagrams, that is essentially calculating the near, that's exactly calculating the near zone metric and then using that to compute the equation's motion. That's the relation between the two formalisms. So instead of working out the equation's motion, we're working at the level of the Lagrangian.
So the near zone is characterized by the distance between the two binary constituents, whereas
the near zone is sort of the area sort of near to the binary, not necessarily, certainly in between, but also somewhere around.
Parametrically, that's.
Yeah, I mean, you can use EFT to calculate that metric simply by computing the one-point function of big H. Okay.
Sure.
So and that's the near zone.
The code, I mean, this is for computing interaction. Do you also compute integrals with that?
Well, not yet, because I have to be able to write down the Feynman diagrams, which then tell me how to write down the expressions. And then at that point, that's where, you know, you need to evaluate integrals. So I'm almost there, about two or three steps away from that, but yeah, that's right. Oh, it's done. How about that? So you see it's actually quite a small number of terms here. And in fact, as promised in the Cole-Smolkin variables, the interaction terms needed, you'll find that there are nothing involving three fields. So in fact, the program actually is able to get that. Okay, sorry.
So one of the original advertisements, at least as I understand it, for the effective field theory approach was that it was going to make the calculations easier. So in that sense, it's a little ironic that you're automating it on the computer. But the real question is there anything...
Well, it still takes time, right? And it's still a long calculation. I said it's easier, not easy.
Right. That wasn't meant to be taken seriously. That's my attempt to be eloquent to introduce the real question, which is there something special about the effective field theory approach that's easier to automate on a computer? Or are you just doing it because that's, you know...
Well, in one sense, so from a matter of time and memory, we're working with scalars, which are... sorry, we're working with actions, which are scalars. So it's a lot easier in terms of computational time. But also, I think an important part of being able to do this is not only that it's a rule-based sort of algorithmic approach just intrinsically, but there's also this step here, which allows us to bypass explicitly solving for the metric perturbation. So we're essentially doing that implicitly by drawing the Feynman diagrams and representing the lines as propagators. So that's implicitly solving the wave equation without actually having to do it explicitly. And so you're really gaining, I think, a lot of roughly, you know, chopping the computational time by at least a factor of two, at least.
So I've met people who do post-Newtonian calculations, when I first was learning GR, I learned it out of partly Weinberg's book, and he says, "Oh, this is the procedure, and you just iterate to get higher orders." And one of the questions I've asked people is, "Well, why don't you just iterate? And what's so? I mean, apart from computation, what's so hard?" And I've heard that, you know, at each order, there are unexpected things that hit you. Like, all of a sudden, there's subtleties of definition of center of mass, and then there's undetermined regulator values and logarithmic terms, and I don't know.
Yeah.
But
so, go ahead.
Why are you confident that, that this is just going to iterate and none of those...
So why not just automate the usual approach, or why does it bother automating?
Well, the automation of the usual approach obviously didn't, I mean, people didn't attempt it, but it wouldn't have been possible anyway. So
earlier I said that full automation is probably, you know, a bit too lofty of a goal, because, for example, though I didn't really get to talk about it, you know, you have these momentum integrals. And as you go higher in the post-Newtonian expansion, these momentum integrals get much more complicated. So for example, by the time you reach 3PN, it was already hard to do. And at 4PN, Alex, I think, was telling me that Thibaut de Moore thinks that it's impossible to evaluate those integrals. I don't know. I mean, you know, at some point, there's going to be a hard part. But I think the nice thing about automating it is that it allows you to separate the problem into what's easily done on a computer. So it separates the tedium from the actual relevant part of the computation. So for example, if you do a 4PN computation with this, you can do all of the contractions, all of the whatever you want, and just focus on exactly that integral you don't know how to evaluate without worrying about, you know, keep on grinding through and so on and so on. So I didn't get to say this, but the integrals that appear here, so every integral can be reduced into a sum of what are called master integrals. And these master integrals, are nice because, you know, particle physicists spend a whole lot of time calculating master integrals. And there's actually books on this stuff and groups and, you know, of course there's Russians doing this, right? So we can use their results from this, hopefully, to calculate these kinds of things. Because, for example, at 4 p.m., there's an integral that we think particle physicists may have already done, or at least somewhat done. So we might be able to borrow their methods and compute that. I don't know. Maybe there's some way to do it numerically. Just don't know. But I think to get back to your question, I think it really allows you to separate the tedium from the relevant part of the calculation really quite cleanly.